Welcome everyone to Room B. This session is on critical care of ICH and TBI. I welcome all of our speakers. Hold on 1 second. We have a very distinguished panel today of speakers, Dr. Awad from the University of Chicago, Dr. Chestnut from the University of Washington, Dr. Cherian from the Institute of Neuroscience, Krishna Institute, Dr. Hanley from Johns Hopkins University, Dr. Haas from Baghdad Teaching Hospital, Dr. Johnson from Loma Linda University, and Dr. Zhang from Loma Linda University. My name is Paul Vespa. I'll be the moderator. My disclosures are below. Today we are going to talk about two topics that are very common topics and important topics in neurocritical care and neurosurgery and neurology, ICH and TBI. This is just the brief outline of what we're going to be discussing. We're going to be having case presentations and then discussion of topics, and we encourage questions and discussion. It's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Awad, who's going to be taking us through an example case. Dr. Awad.
Thank you, Paul, and thank you, distinguished panel and colleagues around the world. Dr. Osman, thank you. So this is a case that is quite often seen by all of us. This is a 36-year-old male. Although young, has had a history of uncontrolled blood pressure and mild renal failure. Is not on anticoagulants, and was transferred from another hospital with very high blood pressure after 14 hours of symptom onset. At this time, he had dense right hemiplegia, left hemiplegia, dense left hemiplegia, GCS of 8, and an ICH volume of about 50 ml by the ABC method. And based on the guidelines for acute management, an external ventricular drain was placed, and the intracranial pressure is reasonably well controlled as the blood pressure is being handled and controlled by the guidelines in the range of 160 to 180. Next slide. So, some of the questions come up as follows. There is not an issue of reversal of anticoagulation. The blood pressure is not an issue we're going to discuss. It's going to be handled by the guidelines. But the question I want to focus on is, should this patient have surgery for the ICH evacuation? And if surgery is being done, is the goal to prevent mortality or to improve functional outcome? What do we know about that? And given what this looks like, is there time to obtain stability scans and etiology screening? Or should he be rushed to surgery? And what technique should be used? Open surgery, endoscopic, minimally invasive thrombolysis, and how soon do we proceed with that? So before I tell you what we did with this case, this is a good way for me to segue to Dr. Hanley, my partner and good colleague, who's going to try to tell you what we know and what we don't know about these questions.
Thanks, Assam. What do we know and what we don't know is really the single most important question in ICH right now. Some things that we know that in any ICH, IVH complicates things and makes it worse. We know for sure that both open surgery in the Stitch 2 trial and minimally invasive surgery in the CLEAR and MISTI trials changes mortality. So we know that surgery can be helpful with mortality. And we know that there's a signal for benefit in functional improvement in the MISTI and CLEAR trials if you get a lot of the hematoma out. We don't know how much hematoma has to come out for sure, but we have good estimates of that. We don't know whether one technique is better than another, although it looks like craniotomy causes more damage than does minimally invasive techniques. And we don't have comparators across the minimally invasive techniques. So those are things we don't know. And one of the biggest things that we don't know is this timing issue. Is there time to stabilize the patient? Is there time to make sure that you don't have a vascular malformation? Is there time to control blood pressure? We know that controlling blood pressure helps overall outcome. We know that knowing that what you're dealing with before you go into the operating room is an important neurosurgical principle that has always benefited the patient. And we know from our own studies and from the STITCH studies that patients can benefit in a time window that appears broad. It appears that that time window is from 12 hours to at least 48 and probably 72 hours. But we need more data on the things that we don't know. Here's a graph that's in the supplement of our MISTI paper that shows that it does take a little bit of time to get the hematoma out, but that on the right-hand side, all the patients who got the procedure had a remarkable decrease in volume. Next slide. This is are the steps that can be done in as quickly as about 12 hours in imaging, and Assam may talk about it a little bit later. But you can see in the lowest panel that you can achieve substantial reductions in hematoma volume, and you can mitigate edema formation. Next slide. Here's a question that we don't fully understand. On the left are a sequence of presentation, post-op, and three-month scans for an endoscopic removal with a rather large encephalomalacic lesion at 3 months and a smaller one using the smaller tool, the MISTI catheter, on the right. We don't know whether the size of the lesion afterwards makes a difference or not. So far, we don't have a signal on this, but it's an important question. Next slide. Here are some pictures of different sized, from 30 on the left to 60 on the right, basal ganglionic hematomas, putaminal or putaminal and caudate, and lobar. And you can see that the lobars that we've selected are nucleated. They're essentially of even density, and you can see the progression in sizes. These are the types of hematomas that are accessible with minimally invasive surgical techniques. Next slide. Not all hematomas are ideal. These are so-called satellite bleeds, and you can see that in the lower panel there is irregularity to some of the lobar hematomas. They often follow the U fibers of the cortex and leave areas of subcortical white matter untouched and are sometimes hard to access with minimally invasive techniques, and we need to consider how we handle these, or if we handle these. I think that's my last slide. So those are some of the things we know and don't know, Assam.
Yeah, so let's go back, if you don't mind, Paul, to the third slide. Yeah, so basically, should we have surgery, the way we approach a case like this is already this patient is young, is receiving very advanced critical care with a ventricular drain, and all the support systems of a modern ICU. So it's not an option that this patient is gonna be just let go, you know. So we're gonna already spend a lot of effort and money to help this patient. So in our approach, we do offer the patient and family the option of mortality reduction with the level one evidence using minimally invasive evacuation, and maybe a shot at helping improve outcome and facilitate neurocritical care by decreasing edema, decreasing the mass lesion, and hastening the care. And we believe the signals are there with the level 2B type evidence that if you remove more than 70% of the clot or are left with less than 15 ml, you will likely derive a functional benefit. The approach that we have evolved to do is a modification of the MISTI procedure that allows us to have the least stress on the healthcare system. So we do not go to the operating room and we do not use conventional image guidance. As you know, image guidance can be a little bit problematic because you're constantly imaging the image before you evacuate the lesion. So you target the hematoma, but then if you aspirate some of it, unless you re-image, you have no idea where the residual hematoma is. Next slide. So what we do, if Paul can show, is actually do this in the CT scanner. At one of the hospitals where we work, there is a CT scanner in the intensive care unit. At another one, it is a procedural CT where people do CT-guided biopsies. So there is room for a table. And basically, we take with us the external ventricular drain kit. And we go to the CT scanner with the neuro ICU team. Typically, anesthesia and the OR team are not involved. The patient is paralyzed and sedated with blood pressure controlled as if they are receiving a procedure in the ICU. And we place the catheter. This one ended up, we will show you the catheter. We did it via a modification of a low bar approach because of the angle of the bleed. And then we evacuate with a syringe as much as we can right there and then re-image the residual hematoma and put a catheter in the residual hematoma. Go ahead and the next slide, please. So basically, this is how it played out in this case. We took an approach from lateral to medial through the superior temporal gyrus, and we put the catheter, and the initial post aspiration looked like it might be a case that is not gonna do very well because of all these satellites and pseudopods of residual hematoma. But in fact, with only a single dose of TPA, the scan on the right side was accomplished, and the measurement of the residual hematoma was less than 10 ml using actual reading center measurement of the residual clot. This is very difficult clot to measure by the ABC method because it's all little pieces, but there are algorithms that we have, and including artificial intelligence algorithm, that allow us to know that we've reached the less than 15 ml. So this was a very, very positive result using a single dose of TPA with this procedure. I believe, look at the mass effect on the ventricle within 12 hours of the procedure. We basically eliminated the ICP problem, removed the EVD, and the patient was moved very, very swiftly to acute rehabilitation. So I want to just turn it back to Dan for a couple more thoughts on how this was handled, and then Paul Vespa for some questions and answers.
Sure. Well, that's a lovely case, Issam. I'd like to make a couple points. We have found now in four different trial data sets with independent adjudication of volume, and volume without independent adjudication is fraught with substantial error, error that can go as big as 20 or 30 milliliters in the estimate. We have found that this 15 milliliter threshold looks like it's a robust threshold. We'd like to find it again, but we found it in the CLEAR trial, in MISTI 2, in MISTI 3, and when Assam and I and our labs looked at the STITCH data, we found it in STITCH 2 as well. So that threshold of what the surgeon needs to do seems like it's a very robust threshold. And it works in a priori statistics for mortality, and it works in per protocol statistics for functional improvement. Paul Vespa, in a trial called ICES, showed that it works for endoscopic removal. Both catheter and endoscopic removal have advantages and disadvantages, and we don't understand what they are. So that would be my scientific overview. From a public health perspective, and I'd love for Dr. Johnson to comment on this, a modern European or North American neurosurgical OR is a very expensive site, and it has to be used by a wide number of individuals. CAT scan and image guidance and all of the equipment isn't readily available to most populations rapidly. CAT scan and a catheter are things that are broadly available across the world, and the kind of simple procedure that does not disrupt the minute-to-minute use of the neurosurgical OR probably has robust viability globally across the world. Those are my two thoughts. Dr. Johnson?
Well, this is a great case, Issam, and congratulations. But as Dr. Hanley mentioned, this sophisticated treatment are not readily available around the world, especially in low resource settings such as low and middle income countries. I would disagree a bit with your comment that CTs and catheters are readily available. The fact of the matter is in high income countries, there's around 42 CT scans per million people. In low resource settings, it's about 0.32 per million. And even if a scan is available, the ability of the patient to pay for it is very limited. Each patient has to pay for each scan, and the majority of people it's not available. The second thing I would say is the 70% of strokes occur in low and middle income countries. And it's not clear, since CTs aren't available, but at least a third of them, many more than in this country, at least a third, and maybe as many as 50% are hemorrhagic strokes, where over here it's 10-12% or so. So this would be fantastic for low resource settings if CTs and people that knew how to do these procedures were available. And then the critical factor as well is there's no acute rehabilitation because, number one, people can't afford it. And even if they could, it's not very much available in any of these countries. So those are my comments. But I have a couple of questions, if I could.
Could I say, give you two clarifying points? Point one, Issam and I are conveners and hosts of the World Intracranial Hemorrhage Conference, which is now in its ninth iteration, I think. And we've been pleased to see that there is what you would call early adoption in these resource-limited settings. We saw a wonderful presentation from the Philippines where access to the CAT scan was paid for by a charity. This procedure that Assam showed you can be done for under $100 US with equipment that was available in the Philippines. We see some early adoption of this capability.
Then I will add also that this is all in relative terms, right? So I think what Walter put in front of us is the real challenge of world epidemiology of stroke in general.
Right.
If you're not going to have a CAT scan to know whether it's a hemorrhage or ischemia, then you know you are the challenges there are to improve more of the elementary elements of care. But assuming you get to a situation such as in Karachi or Cairo or Alexandria or Nairobi, where CAT scan is not a problem, is it better to do it with a catheter or is it better to do it with an endoscope that costs $1,500, you know, and so forth? So those are the relative issues that we're trying to put on the table a little bit. And even if it is done with relatively simple terms, I just want to add that you've got to follow the protocols extremely closely in terms of safety and effectiveness. This is not something where you put the catheter and you turn the case loose. In that case, it's probably better not to do it.
Right. The rehab question, just one quick point there. we've seen with clot extraction, once in ischemic stroke, once the procedure was well developed and the safety elements defined, we've seen that there's less need for rehab because people come out of the procedure at a higher functional level, which is what happened here. MRS of 3 at 1 month in a brain hemorrhage is unusual.
Absolutely.
Please, your questions.
One of the slides said that there was irrigation with Alteplase.
Yes, one dose.
One dose, okay. And that is done into the clot, correct?
Yes, in the catheter that you see in the middle picture.
Right, and how long do you leave the drain in then?
So the drain is left a day after the last dose of Alteplase. So Alteplase is given until you reach that less than 15 ml evacuation. In this case, only one dose was needed. The catheter is removed the following day.
We've done kinetics, Dr. Johnson, on the Alteplase. 24 hours is more than 5 half-lives, so its effect is no longer there, which makes the removal of the catheter safe.
Well, the wonderful thing is WHO has their model list of essential medicines that every country is supposed to make available. And urokinase, streptokinase, and Alteplase are all included on that. So
right.
Hopefully, I mean, that's certainly far, it's the ideal. It's far from the reality, sadly. But at least they understand the necessary nature of having these drugs available.
Right. That's encouraging, very encouraging. And I think nascent teams of neurocritical care, neurosurgeons and neurologists can emerge even in the setting of early developing environments with universities and medical schools rising to this, even in the poorest countries. And just like in the US, we have many areas that are very underserved and do not get the level of care that they deserve. But I think the stroke center concept of nascent teams will start elevating the bar and showing what can be done even in local settings.
And the demand is going through the roof. People understand that this is much better outcomes and with the cell phones and everybody's becoming aware of these things and social media, the demand is growing.
There's a question from our attendees. What are your neurological condition and age cutoffs for offering minimally invasive management?
So let me take a hit at that. We follow the standards that were used, the protocols that were used in the trials, so that not to fall into false generalization. So we do not use this procedure on people who have already herniated, who have dilated pupils, who are in an impending herniation and instability setting. But otherwise, the GCS eligibility is very broad. So in my practice, GCS of 5 to 14 is what gets this procedure. So the greatest benefits seem to be in the middle range of GCS. The people between 7 and 11 are the ones where we make a huge difference on. But there is a signal benefit in all three GCS settings. Dan, is that your thoughts as well?
Yeah, two other minor issues. We don't do it when the family says, you know, we talked this over and my loved one said if they had a stroke, they didn't want to survive. So we don't do that. And the GCS, I think one has to be careful about. If the patient has been sedated, using the GCS as a discriminator for procedure versus no procedure is unwise. I would favor where there's doubt, not using GCS as a discriminator. We've used a cutoff of 80 in age, but in the last two trials that we've done, we've moved to functional status rather than age as a cutoff. And if someone is living independently and is a Rankin 0, 1, or perhaps 2, but we've taken 1 as a threshold, then we've done it if they're over 80.
So in countries such as China and others, neurologists have little devices for evacuating hematomas, especially lobar ones.
Yep.
Are you training neurologists to do this in low resource settings?
I'm a pretty clumsy guy, and Issam doesn't allow me to use sharp objects.
You know, Paul was probably the example, the leading example of neurologists doing this procedure, even at a high socioeconomic setting like West LA. So I think I have no trouble with well-trained neurologists.
Right.
But I think another important thing that we learned from this is that achieving the endpoint and experience with this procedure are essential to its functional benefits. So you basically lose the ability to save life and improve function if you put the catheter sideways and not into the clot and, you know, put TPA in the brain instead of the clot, which are things that can happen if we loosen up the protocol too much. So I don't really care in particular who does it as long as we are very rigorous about our technique, which in neurosurgery is a big deal, right? You shouldn't do bad brain surgery.
Exactly.
Let me go back to my a little joke for a second. It was with a purpose. We're looking at the training, the number of cases it needs to train in our data, and we hope to do that in our next trial. It looks like somewhere between 5 and 10 procedures with a neurosurgeon who's more skilled than I am is enough. If you go to the Chinese craniopuncture data, it looks like the internists and medical doctors and neurologists who do this are doing case series of 200 to 1,000, and that good experience begins to happen perhaps at a larger number. I am all in favor of where your question was heading, that the skilled provider is the one who you want, and it doesn't matter what their prior training was. And I think Paul Vespa has shown us that.
Thanks, everyone. I think we need to move on to TBI, and for the sake of time, thanks for an excellent discussion. Dr. Chestnut is trying to get onto the session, having some technical difficulties, but we're going to go on.
Thank you so much for this.
Thank you. Thank you so much. We're going to go on and have a discussion about TBI, and Dr. Chestnut has provided a number of slides. Dr. Haas has some as well. So these are Dr. Chestnut's slides. So I'm going to start for him. Hopefully he can sign on here. But essentially, this is a case, a patient with traumatic brain injury here, comes in to the trauma center, and has a number of other injuries as well, and has initial CT imaging here with, as you can see, contusions, temporal contusion, skull fracture, as Dr. Chestnut is actually as outlined here for you. And the issue is how should this patient be treated? What are sort of some of the decision making that goes into evaluating and treating a patient such as this? And what are some options in terms of early medical management, early surgical management, and so forth? So there's a symmetric exam, there's some aphasia, and there's an initial evaluation of the patient. And I'll just back up just a second and just see what our panel may think here. Dr. Johnson, perhaps you can give us a sort of a brief discussion of what you would, how you would approach this kind of patient in the early hours.
Well, there are several things of concern. First of all, his BMI is 33, so this is not a small person you're dealing with, who may have blood pressure issues, underlying health issues as a baseline. My primary concern, though, is the extent of this, and it looks, majority of it in the temporal lobe, and his chance, in fact, on the upper right CT scan, looks like there is very imminent herniation. If it isn't happening, then it's going to happen. I'd be very, very concerned about this this patient herniating. It's a sufficient blow to cause a skull fracture. So I'd be very concerned about him.
And I think perhaps Dr. Chestnut is on now.
Yeah, Randy? Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah.
Hi.
Yeah. Sorry.
Go ahead.
I mean, on is Randall.
We were getting started. Please go ahead.
Yeah. No. This guy actually, I think your concern is quite correct. This guy came in looking pretty good.
I'm not sure if Randy is on or not. I see. Stephanie, do you know if Dr. Chestnut is on?
I can hear him, Paul.
Oh, okay. I'm happy.
I apologize for that, but. We were concerned about this guy. He looked pretty good clinically. He didn't look as bad as his scan. We figured he was aphasic because of the lesion. So we initially did not think he was directly a surgical candidate, but we were concerned that he might be. He had no evidence of herniation based on pupillometry or exam. So we actually considered not operating on him initially.
Randy, this is Dan Hanley. The one thing you see on the CT, though, is no CSF spaces, which could suggest that Dr. Johnson's prediction might be right.
Yeah, it might be. I mean, we put it, again, I think as we progress in the slides, we'll come up with some issues. We initially put in a monitor in the ED within, you know, a very short time after he came to help us answer that question. Because it's dominant temporal lobe, and we were quite concerned that he'd be you know, that about what we were going to do about the injury itself and about whether or not he's aphasic. We were not certain it was directly surgical, but we did put an ICP monitor in intraparenchymal, you know, which we do in the emergency department.
That's a complex set of concerns. So you had a thought process for it. So it sounds great to me.
Yeah. Makes sense.
Initially, his ICP was low. We put him in the ICU. We looked at his physiologic parameters according to the CIBIC 1 Tier 0 approach, with the recommendation of head up, observation, sedation, and analgesia as indicated, physiologic resuscitation, setting his initial CPP as 20, initial hematocrit or hemoglobin level as 7. We set him up physiologically. He is a big fellow, which is a bit awkward. And his ICP actually stayed pretty good. It stayed in the teens. Unfortunately, we did a routine follow-up CT scan at 4 hours. Just go ahead and advance a couple there, Paul. And the lesion was worse. So this is what we talked about setting up and then management with and without ICP. I think there's probably a lot in the audience, and there's a lot of places in the world that don't have ICP monitoring. So that would be following the CREVIS protocol, which is for treatment of traumatic brain injury based on suspected intracranial hypertension. This fellow would meet the suspected intracranial hypertension criteria based on his CT scan and on several aspects of his exam. But we did put an ICP monitor in over 4 hours. You can see it drifted between about 4 and 20. The Leacock began to react, and it gave us normal values. But we got a CT scan in follow-up. And next slide there. And as you can see, the lesion was bigger. So I think in the long run, Walter's idea was quite on track. And so we did a decompressive craniectomy. We have kind of gone over to the Kempe incision at the University of Washington because it's user-friendly, it's quick, and if you have to turn it into a bilateral incision, it can be easily done or for later bifrontal involvement. But post-operatively, he looked pretty good. His exam was unchanged. He was decompressed, but we got a CT venogram, and as you can see, based on the fractures that we saw up front, he has embarrassment of his left transverse and sigmoid sinus. Any thoughts about how that can contribute to intracranial hypertension? Anybody change their therapy based on that, or it's kind of a sticky wicket?
It can contribute to intracranial hypertension. My point early on after Walter made his was the primary buffer for ICP in globally and locally is the CSF, but the secondary buffer is the cerebral venous blood volume system, and you've just compromised a significant portion of it. It looks like from this venogram, particularly the upper right, that you do have a contralateral dominant jugular system. So it may not have compromised it as much as it would have if the lesional side had been the dominant side.
Yeah, that's it. These certainly contribute to intracranial hypertension, and it's a venous blood volume issue, which is a bit problematic in terms of therapy. But we were concerned about that. Next slide.
You should be, because the problem is that you have circulatory compromise, and hyperventilation is more likely to produce ischemia in a scenario like this.
But there's a possibility that there is a venous infarct in this case, probably the vein of Labe. So that could have led later on to the transverse sigmoid problem, but that was there from the first scan onwards. And in even in after surgery, after decompression, you can see that. So maybe that should also be taken into account.
Yeah, I think these are all good points. We now have a bit of a source of intracranial hypertension that's not as easily managed, and it will give you intracranial hypertension and often will persist for 10 days. And that's what we were concerned about. I mean, I think the slide that Paul just went to was the decompressive craniectomy slide. I think we're probably all familiar with that. Kempe is the same as any other approach, a large decompressive craniectomy. We saw the results of Peter Hutchinson's study that suggested that decompressive craniectomy done when you have well-established intracranial hypertension versus early hypertension, such as in the DECRA trial. Peter's study suggested that you can improve mortality. The question of improving morbidity is really a question of the level of recovery, and severe disability may or may not be acceptable recovery. But in this fellow, I don't think we had any choice. I think we had swelling in a critical area, and you don't even have to have exceptionally high ICP to herniate with a temporal lobe lesion. So I think, as Walter pointed out, and as we performed, decompression is the right thing. I don't think anybody here would have evacuated the clot in a dominant temporal lobe, or is there someone who would?
No.
Well, I wouldn't have gone with a decompression there. In this case, if you see that the hematoma would have come out. Just because it's a dominant temporal lobe, you really doesn't have to decompress. I mean, that just shows that the temporal lobe is going to herniate out more, and that's going to create more damage than if you take out the hematoma through a superficial incision, if it's coming out. And then after that, I would have opened the cisterns. That's what I would have done differently. I would not have performed a decompressive here.
And what Ipe pointed out, the potential for both cortical venous thrombosis and the and the sinus thrombosis, it's going to make any attempt at hematoma extraction very, very difficult. You're going to have a major bleeding problem.
Yes, I agree completely. I mean, since the veins, this may have been a traumatic vein of Labbe problem to start with. So hematoma evacuation would have been a bit messy, but rather than decompression, where the brain is decompressed and the hematoma could go on, a venous infarct could go on increasing, and the whole temporal lobe could herniate outside. I mean, this case went off very well, I see, but I would rather evacuate the hematoma through a small incision, open the cisterns with the large flap, open the cisterns, and just leave the bone back. I wouldn't do a decompressive here. You can see here you can see that the brain is herniating out here. You can see through clearly that at least about 25 ml of brain is definitely herniating out here. If you put the bone back, that damage would be much less.
Well, in the long run, it didn't actually herniate out and it wasn't damaged. As you can see, if we continue along with the case, the patient did have some element of intracranial hypertension that after the surgery, it was actually, the highest was something on the order of 32. It generally ran in between about 24, 26. We followed essentially the CIBIC 1, well, we had a Lycox in, so we followed the CIBIC 2 protocol, which would be type B, which is abnormal ICP and normal brain tissue oxygen. And so this would be type B, and we followed that. We did treat him intermittently with hypertonics, and he tended to have normal pupils, normal oxygen, a really pretty normal waveform. Paul, can you go ahead and show that? And indeed, he had autoregulation when we tested that. So we did it basically by altering his blood pressure and looking at his transcranial Doppler flow and his ICP response. And so what we decided after a couple of days of hypertonics, where he was tending to stay between 24 and 26 with normal waveform, normal autoregulation, and no normal pupil exam, we eventually allowed him to run at 24 to 26, backed off his sedation, and he quite quickly was localizing without any concomitant issues. So what we ended up doing was giving a bit of permissive intracranial hypertension, because the venous side outflow problem is difficult to treat otherwise, and he actually ended up doing fine.
Sounds like you maintained CPP.
Yeah, very carefully, and we were also checking it with brain tissue oxygen. So I think this is a case where we knew we were going to have intracranial hypertension, and the question was, is the intracranial hypertension at the low level that it existed actually harming the patient versus escalating treatment? And we felt it wasn't, and so we adjusted the ICP threshold.
Is there, since you work in a great institution, is there any role for interventional neuroradiology? They're doing venous angioplasties and thrombosis or thrombolysis routinely now. Any role for them?
Well, we ended up anticoagulating him, aspirin on day 3 and heparin on day 5. You know, as far as doing it interventionally, we do a fair amount of that, but not necessarily in the case of trauma or intracranial hypertension. Our interventionalists are still a little reticent of taking someone to the angio suite and fooling around with their venous system in the face of ongoing intracranial hypertension. And we weren't sure we were going to get away with the adjusted ICP threshold.
Something to consider, I would think.
Certainly, yes.
As an internist, I'd be concerned with that fracture that you have periosteal tear in the sinus, and that a rapid opening of the occlusion may not be as safe as a heparin-based, more slow approach.
You're concerned about air?
No, that you had a tear.
And
if you did a stent, for example, or local thrombolysis, which are the two approaches that have been used, that you might actually then get a posterior fossa subdural.
Well, the alternative of anticoagulation was pretty tenuous at that early after trauma, but
right.
But we seem to have gotten away with it on this case.
Right. My point is, it works more slowly.
Yeah, exactly.
And it allows for whatever the local thrombotic mechanisms that are keeping you from getting a subdural to perhaps continue and balance out the opening of the. Did it open up?
You know, actually, we don't have that long term. We only treated him a month ago, and we don't have a follow up CT venogram yet. He seems to be doing okay. He's at rehabilitation. He's doing his activities of daily living. He's got a mild right hemiparesis, and he's definitely quite aphasic in both of his languages.
Does he have a memory? He has contralateral mesial temporal lobe injury that looks like what you often see as the bilateral temporal lobe injury of herpes simplex, and many of these people don't have functional memory.
I actually don't know that result from his rehab.
It'll show itself in 6 to 12 months.
Just to finish, this patient in a lot of parts of the world would have been monitored when treated without intracranial pressure monitoring. I suspect he would have been decompressed initially. But without intracranial pressure monitoring, if the best trip trial showed anything, it showed that you can do pretty well with just good critical care and attention to the patient in the general population of severe traumatic brain injury. I think this fellow met criteria for treatment of suspected intracranial hypertension. He would have been put on scheduled mannitol, I think. And then watched for deterioration with escalation based on clinical findings. I suspect, in truth, that this fellow might have done fairly well without an ICP monitoring treated by the Krebs protocol.
I agree. Sadly, for many people with this kind of injury around the world, they would, whether it's a moped or falling off out of a coconut tree, there's no ICU, so many people wouldn't survive this in many low resource settings.
Yeah, that's true. But if they do survive to hospital, I think that the hopeful news is that with good critical care and attentive management, they have a reasonable shot. I don't think the lack of our fancy toys should prevent our assiduous critical care in low and middle income countries.
Absolutely.
I want to point out that that's the same theme that came across in the last presentation. If you know what to do, there is a way to do it.
Hi, everybody.
Hi, Dr. Haas. What are your thoughts?
It was a nice discussion about the intensive care issues. For sure, I'm practicing in Baghdad, Iraq. We have a lot of trauma, and in spite of that, we don't have ICP monitors for any patient. So it's maybe a different pathway or era, but we should keep with the standards. I don't know if I can present the cases, Stephanie.
Your slide is now showing, Dr. Haas.
Yes. Next slide, please. So my talk will be just giving maybe two slides about different type of injury. It's a blast induced traumatic brain injury. What we say when we say blast in Iraq, usually it's a car bombing or suicidal attack. This is quite common. I think Iraq, and especially Baghdad, the center of Iraq, is the one of the hottest spot in the world dealing with this terroristic attack over the last maybe more than 10 years. So in the mind map or in the diagram shown, you can imagine the situation that there is a huge double suicidal bombing attack by two bombing cars at the same time, at the same place with a crowded population. What we receive in our hospital, which is the neurosurgery teaching hospital, only neurosurgery, a specialized center. As you see in the diagram, we receive a 75 patient to the ER first. Dealing with these patients require planning, require different management technique. I think there will be a lot of change in prioritizing the steps. That's the main idea while receiving 75 patients in the ER. First of all, for sure, there is the resuscitation. And after the resuscitation, we lost 19 patients at the ER. And from that, there is 56 patients require treatment. From those, there is 39. That's the main number here. There is 39 patients require surgery. All of them present at the same time. That's what the blast-induced traumatic brain injury entails. Actually, receiving those patients, 39, let's say 40, requiring surgery, and which patient you should do the surgery for him first. That's how to do the priority. I think at that time, we spend 3 or 4 successive days in the OR. We have 3 to 4 OR theaters and doing the surgery continually for a few days while finishing those cases. That's a major challenge when you have such gush of cases at the same time. And for sure, not all the cases require surgery. Some require conservative treatment, whether they are in very good condition or they are in very bad condition. I mean, patient with GCS like 3 or 4 with the penetrating shell or multiple shell, this is not a priority for surgery for us, but patient with a large shell stuck in the head and causing midline compression, that will be the priority. Here you can find a variety of injuries you can encounter, and that's why you must have a planned management strategy. And there is a multiple teams, team working in the OR, team working and team working in the CT scan, because this team will take the decision whether to send the patient directly to the OR or prepare him in the ICU or admit him to the emergency department. That's just to give a general idea. There is all types of injury you can suspect in these cases, maybe vascular injury. Many of you can expect there is a sinus injury in most of the cases, because it's because of the waves of the blast. So there is a primary and secondary and even tertiary injury, because the people are pushed by the wave of the blast. I think this give a general idea about the topic. And if we go to the next, in the last year, there is a protest, a crowded protest in Baghdad near our hospital, anti-governmental protest, and there is a tear gas canister thrown against the protesters. That's common everywhere in the world, but what occurred in Baghdad in 2019, that we receive 40 cases of head injury caused by tear gas canisters. Actually, in this publication, we take only the cases that the canister, which should be a safe one, penetrate the skull fully. There is a full penetration of the canister inside the head, and these are 10 patients. All of them died eventually, but we analyzed the data, because I think it's a very rare injury, and even Amnesty advised that this type of tear gas canister is not for civilian use. They are old and usually used in the past for military purposes. But as from neurosurgery perspective, that was a very challenging with this large penetrating object. I think it's a strange CT scan to see what's this large object, and we are pushed to do surgery. If you consider yourself in the position of a managing surgeon in such cases, can you leave this large object and do you expect the patient to improve? For sure not. Any patient with any GCS above 5 or above 4, we operate them. We try to extract the cases. One of the cases we failed to extract it because it's severely adhered to the torcula, and there is a huge bleeding with each time we are trying to moving it. And actually, apart from the surgery, and there is a possibility of toxicity. As you know, there is a toxic gas inside these canisters. And what are the real effects? We don't know. It's a strange injury, but it came in a gush over 2 days. We received 40 cases from a penetrating head injury caused by tear gas canister. I think in this article we described many scenarios, but this one is a difficult one. We try to do circumferential craniectomy as wide as possible. For sure, there is no dura to make a duroplasty or each type. We use direct facial extraction, and we put it above the defect after removing the canister and make the hemostasis. That's the general idea from my talk, and I'm waiting for your comments, sir.
These are very challenging situations when you have the mass occurrence of intracranial injury. Could you tell us a little bit about how you organized your team to triage to get such positive results, where only half of the individuals died and you had a substantial number who were able to be independent at discharge?
Thank you, sir, for the question. Actually, it's by the frequency of blast injuries. I think sometimes in 2008, there is a daily two or three major blasts in Iraq. So with time, we are organized to be teams. All the team must contain a decision-making neurosurgeon, one in the OR, one in the CT scan, as I said, because in the OR, one in the ER, while taking decision after resuscitation to send this patient direct to CT scan or to go to the ICU or sometimes direct to surgery, even without CT scan. You are obligated to do some such decisions. The second team will be at the CT scan to take the decision about the next step. The third team will be in the ICU. The ICU team must include a decision-making neurosurgeon, for sure with a resident, because in the ICU, you are prioritizing your patient, which patient I will send him now to the surgery and which patient will stay up to 2 or 3 hours later. And what should I do in this time? Yeah, like using monitor, even sometimes you are forced to use steroids, although you know that it may be not helpful, but you are using all the possible armamentarium. And at the OR, we have in each the theater, there is a surgeon and resident operating on each case, because as I said, you need this is not cases for resident. You can face a major venous bleeding or major arterial bleeding at any time during the procedure. So decision making will not wait for just a surgeon like supervising three parallel surgeries doing by residents. It's not this type of situation. You need a surgeon with good experience at each surgery. And at the same time, there is a priority while inside. Sometimes we don't close the dura. Sometimes we put, I think most of you professor may face this in some cases, we put like the carotid patty inside the brain just to stop the bleeding, leave it and close the skin.
Dr. Haas, I apologize. We have to go ahead and close this session for today. We appreciate all of you and your great knowledge. We need to close the session.
Thank you, Dr. Haas. That was a wonderful presentation.
Thank you all.
Thank you, sir.